If 1966 is remembered for nothing else, the black mark of mass murder is etched permanently on the pages of the year's history. In Chicago in July, the early morning quiet on that city's south side was shattered by screams. A young nurse had survived a night of horror. When police entered the apartment building, they found the bodies of 8 young student nurses stabbed or strangled. Cook County Coroner Andrew Tolman summed it up.
It was a crime of the century. It's one of the worst crimes I've ever seen since I've been a coroner.
Within days, a one-time sailor and drifter, 24-year-old Richard Speck, was arrested and charged with the massacre. The University of Texas Library Tower overlooks the entire campus and most of the city of Austin. Today, that stately edifice is pockmarked, visible evidence of 16 senseless murders, all done by one young man. 24-year-old Charles Whitman had one mission, to kill. He did. Whitman had murdered his wife and mother, then methodically took an arsenal of weapons to the university tower and began firing expertly at those below, killing 13 total strangers, wounding more than 30 others, before his own life was ended by a policeman's bullet. Later, a brother of the demented youth told WKNR News,
he was on the honor roll and he was architectural engineering. He was an ex-Marine. He was the youngest Eagle Scout in the world at one time. He's never done anything wrong in his life, actually. And that's about it.
On November 12th, a youngster walked into a beauty school in Mesa, Arizona, shot and killed 4 women and a 3-year-old youngster. 18-year-old Benjamin Smith was captured at the scene, led away laughing, saying he wanted attention. On February 12th, a world-renowned Jewish leader, Rabbi Morris Adler, was conducting a bar mitzvah at the Shaarei Tzedek Synagogue in suburban Southfield. Suddenly, the ecumenical services were interrupted. A horrified congregation watched as a young man shot the rabbi, then turned the gun on himself. Within moments, an eyewitness told WKNR News,
the rabbi said, He said, don't stay where you are. He said, don't come any further. I said, you know this man? He said, yes, I know him. I know him pretty well. And as he finished his talk, he walked over to the rabbi and he was shaking his head and he said, the rabbi, I'm sorry. And then he shot him twice. And then after that, pulled the trigger on himself.
4 days later, the gunman, 24-year-old Richard Wisniewski, died. He had been counseled by the rabbi for mental disturbances. Rabbi Adler died early in March. Murder was on the rise throughout the nation in 66. And in Detroit, some frightening statistics. 230 killings, the highest since 1929. Perhaps Homicide Inspector Albert Schwaller summarized it best.
I think their attitude toward these homicides would give the indication that possibly life is much cheaper today than what it has been, the value on one's life.
The nation's courtrooms provided dramatic new chapters in jurisprudence throughout the year. There were new rulings from the nation's highest court, including sweeping limitations on police in questioning criminal suspects. And the High Court ordered a new trial for Cleveland osteopath Sam Shepard. Shepard had spent 9 years in prison after conviction for the 1954 murder of his wife, Marilyn. In a second trial, he was acquitted. Late in the year, the Supreme Court said no to Jimmy Hoffa, refusing to review his conviction on jury tampering charges. The decision apparently paved the way to prison for the fiery Teamster Union president. In Detroit, loyal members of Hoffa's home local threatened a sympathy work stoppage that could have seriously curtailed the city's activities. Hoffa personally appealed in an impassioned Cobo Hall speech and again unleashed a verbal attack on the Justice Department. Our WKNR microphones were there.
They formed a squad known as the Hoffa Squad. For the first time in the history of the United States, to where they delegated certain FBI representatives, certain stool pigeons with an undetermined amount of money to be able to follow me, harass me, wiretap me, room bug me, surveil me, steal my records, destroy my home if they could, and I refuse again to surrender.
Every year has its share of labor management disputes. Perhaps this past one set a new precedent. Public employee walkouts. In New York, subways ground to a halt as the new year started. Massive traffic jams followed. A judge issued an injunction. The union defied it. And Transport Workers President Mike Quill said,
"The judge can drop dead in his black robes. We will not call off the strike."
Within the month, Quill himself was dead of a heart attack. A six-week strike against five major airlines proved costly in more ways than one. The settlement cracked the administration's wage guidelines. In Lansing, city workers walked out. City services were halted for a week. In Detroit, Ecorse and Warren, many residents watched garbage pile up as DPW workers struck. Detroit strike was viewed by DPW Director Robert Toohey.
"We collect from hospitals and from schools, from restaurants, and of course from private homes. And you can imagine the unsanitary situation and dangerous situation that will result if this sort of refuse is allowed to accumulate for any period of time."
All of the walkouts finally ended. One of the nation's newest labor leaders, the president of the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, Jerry Wirth, was asked if Michigan was a prime target.
"That sounds to me like something that was said by a mayor in a city in Michigan. It's not true. There have been strikes of public employees all over this country. We're not singling out Ohio or California or New York or Wisconsin."
In Pontiac, city police went on a sick call boycott. It lasted 2 days. And when the boycott ended, a full-fledged strike was threatened.
"Unless the city expedites their demands with a realistic pay increase and their long-promised longevity plan, they will in fact strike, regardless of any penalties that they might be subjected to."
Pontiac Police Association President Herbert Cooley. The city and the police reached an agreement late in the year. There was no strike. And upcoming in the new year, UAW auto industry contract talks. Walter Reuther looked ahead for WKNR News.
"Well, we haven't shaped our demands. All we want is equity. We, the workers in General Motors and Ford and Chrysler and other segments of the UAW, all they ask for and all we will fight for is our equitable share of the increase in productivity that the labor of our members contributes towards."
1966 was also the year of the teacher strike. They started early in April and raged on into autumn.
"The ridiculous idea of each of you individually crawling back on your hands and knees to beg the school board for your job back and to be placed somewhere on a salary schedule is absolutely ridiculous. Thank you."
The concentration of the walkouts was in Michigan. Teachers left the classrooms and walked picket lines. High school graduation ceremonies were threatened as the instructors demanded more pay, more say, fewer students, and less work. The suburb of Ecorse was a prime target. The teachers pulled out, saying they wouldn't be back without a contract and more money. The school board wasn't too impressed. They fired all 197 teachers. There was reaction.
"If we don't have a contract here in September, there won't be any school. If they think they can hire 196 teachers, they have to be smoking opium."
"This is a typical union-busting tactic that was familiar to any laborers in the 1930s and early 40s. The teachers' union now will stand strong as the UAW did in those days."
"They're going to continue their regular strike activities."
After mediation, that dispute drew to a close. But there were others. Highland Park, Taylor Township, Riverview, Dearborn Heights, Wayne, the Crestwood District, and Hamtramck all had teacher picket lines. A new day of teacher militancy had arrived, and the school boards were less than enthusiastic about their newfound bedfellows. In September, the nation's first college teacher strike, occurring at the Henry Ford Community College just as fall term registration began. A professor, Dr. Archie Allen, led those strikers.
"Well, I'm certain, as several of our people have said, that there are people throughout the country and certainly throughout the state that are watching what's happening here. And I think it will have an impact on higher education throughout the country."
The Dearborn Board of Education said they'd close down the college. The teachers suddenly rekindled their dedication to the art of education and went back to the classrooms, forfeiting a week's pay in the process. Detroit's Northern High School was racked by student protests in the spring. The students angered over censorship of a school paper editorial claiming they were being shortchanged in their education. A full-scale walkout followed, with students demanding the ouster of longtime Northern principal Arthur Carty. They wanted, they said, more study space, more recreational areas, and more stimulation. A kind of contraband school was set up at a nearby church. They called it a freedom school, with Negro history and civil rights the prime topics. One of the leaders of the student boycott, Michael Batchelor, was questioned by WKNR's Eric Smith.
We expect immediate action from the Board of Education. Either they'll down us or they'll uprise us.
Are you afraid they'll down you?
I am.
What will happen if they do?
We'll continue to stay out, I believe. The Board of Education, as we felt and as we've told other people, have not given us the consideration that we're looking for.
The Northern students received strong support from many sections. The boycott was finally resolved. Said school superintendent, Dr. Samuel Brownell.
Whatever I did, you could interpret as yielding to pressure, because I've been pressured to do everything. So whatever I did, you could interpret as being yielding to pressure.
Northern principal Arthur Carty was a man without a school, exiled to the board's downtown offices. Some said the action was a new day dawning on the troubled school system. Others more sensibly viewed it as a retreat and a concession to a new wave of anarchy developing across the land.
Ain't no question about it. We just got to organize and stop being ashamed and afraid to tell the man what's been on our mind for 400 years. Because black power is scaring the hell out of them, and we ain't even organized yet.
Stokely Carmichael, one of the new young lions in the civil rights movement. His call for black power touched off sharp controversy. The young militants took up the cry. The old line leaders denounced it, but tried to explain. Dr. Martin Luther King, in a Detroit appearance, was questioned by WKNR.
Very definitely. I don't see anything wrong with driving for power. It isn't a new word. I've been using it all along. Maybe I don't call it black power, but I call it power. I think the great problem that we face is that we are powerless.
In many cities, another summer of rioting. The worst hit Chicago, Cleveland, San Francisco, Atlanta. In Michigan, Benton Harbor, Muskegon, and Lansing. And on an August night on Detroit's Near East Side.
You're a train! You're a train!
Fast, efficient work by the city's police quelled that outbreak before it could mushroom. There were arrests, but little bloodshed. The question remained, is the civil rights movement going forward or backward? No one seemed quite sure. There were disasters in 1966 in Wales, in the Far East, in Italy, in Turkey and Peru. Thousands died. On storm-tossed Lake Huron, the ore carrier Daniel J. Morrell went down, taking 28 of 29 crewmen. Air crashes killed hundreds and made headlines. But buried in the day-to-day statistics of our revolving world, a mounting traffic death toll that neared 1,000 a week. In the Detroit area, no accident seemed as tragic as one just before Christmas, when a sand-loaded truck crashed into a school bus in Windsor. 8 of 30 children were killed. A frightened survivor spoke with WKNR.
Well, we were driving in the dump truck, all the sand came into the bus.
Did you get a lot of sand on you?
Yes.
Where was it? Was it in your face?
Well, a little bit was in my mouth.
Did you just see the truck all of a sudden and then the sand came in?
No, I didn't see the truck.
Auto safety. A major news story of the year. A Connecticut attorney named Ralph Nader had published a book called Unsafe at Any Speed. The question, were cars as safe as they should be and could be? There were Washington hearings. Nader appeared, so did many others. The self-styled auto expert accused General Motors of prying into his personal life. The giant corporation admitted it, and there was a public apology from GM President James Roach.
As president of General Motors, I hold myself fully responsible for any action authorized or initiated by any officer of the corporation which may have had any bearing on the incidents related to our investigation of Mr. Nader.
When the hearings had ended, Congress rushed headlong into passage of an auto safety bill requiring certain federal standards for 68 model cars. The bill hit the industry where it hurts. And Henry Ford put it succinctly before WKNR microphones.
Many of these standards, these temporary standards, I think are unreasonable. I think they're arbitrary, and I think they're technically not feasible.
Mr. Ford even hinted application of some of the proposed standards could close down assembly lines. Earlier, the outspoken Ford Motor chairman had said if Ralph Nader was a technical expert, there was a job for him.
And he said some very interesting things here this morning. He even says that he doesn't think the rear axles are well engineered. Well, I say we got jobs for rear axle engineers, and if he's that good, we'll be happy to give him a job.
Nader continued to expound his layman's theories on how to run the auto industry. In a Detroit appearance, he talked with WKNR News.
Their collapse characteristics are very, very reminiscent of sardine cans. Seats are not moored properly.
Once during the year, Nader switched to the safety problems of oil and gas pipelines. That didn't stir much interest, so he went back to automobiles. By year's end, the industry agreed some standards could be met and some couldn't. The problem of traffic deaths remained, and the fatality lists grew. And it would seem some Americans could commit highway suicide driving an armored tank. It was a year of ups and downs and questions and theories as to the economy. A rash of price increases heightened the degree of inflation. Money was tight. Housing starts reached an all-time low. The cost of living continued to climb. Some housewives marched outside the supermarkets they usually marched into. Struggling American Motors took a bath, revealing losses of more than $12 million. A new board chairman took over, Robert B. Evans.
I think results have gotten by stimulation and new ideas, new inspirations from leadership.
Late in the year, there was unconfirmed talk of an AMC merger. Still, there was optimism. Chrysler's Lynn Townsend, newly named board chairman, told WKNR News,
"In our opinion, the fourth quarter of this year will be prosperous for the industry. Retail sales for the year should reach just over 9 million units, second only to the 1965 record."
Bank failures are not too common these days. Detroit had one in 66. The public bank went under, and the Bank of the Commonwealth took over the remaining assets. Commonwealth's president, George Miller, explained.
"We were able, through this transaction, to avoid, for all intents and purposes, the real closing of public bank. It did business as usual yesterday, and it is doing business as usual today. And that's pretty good, as far as I'm concerned."
Public stockholders were unhappy. A series of lawsuits were instigated, but there was no legal action. 66 had its economic problems, but as the new year began, the banners were still flying high. Americans began to accept space flights as somewhat routine. As we took giant steps toward the moon, the Gemini program was completed despite some cliffhangers. The accomplishments were many, including rendezvous between Gemini 6 and 7.
Gemini 6, Hawaii, Capcom, can you give me a status?
Yeah, we're in formation with 7. Everything is going here.
Roger, congratulations. Excellent.
Thank you, a lot of fun.
Later, our astronauts docked, walked in space. We even saw some close-up pictures of the lunar surface. And as the Apollo program gets underway, the moon gets closer to man every day. Other things happened in the skies in the past year.
Looked up and I saw as if someone had shot a skyrocket from downtown. I just saw the trail and it just blew up.
Well, we saw this big light like, and we thought it was a meteor. We just started screaming. Everything was all lit up and...
Well, I don't know what I've seen. It's just big orange balls flying through the sky.
A huge meteor swept across much of the Midwest, frightening a few, fascinating many. Other strange phenomena appeared in the skies over Michigan.
A big light, all the light was, well, you can't say the shape of how round it was, but it was bright, where it was cut out like a hole. It was sort of silver gray. But you could tell it was no, it got to be some kind of spaceship. But you could see it's still, it we was close and I was 6 hours looking at it.
Those annual visitors, UFOs. The Air Force acquiesced and sent astronomer Dr. J. Allen Hynek to investigate. He questioned and listened, and then on a Friday afternoon at the Detroit Press Club, calmly explained,
"This could have been due to the release of variable quantities of marsh gas. The disappearance of the light when people got close with flashlights or car lights would indicate that the glow seemed bright to dark, adapted eyes."
The theory wasn't exactly what everyone wanted to hear. It seems we would like to believe someone is out there watching. Some names passed from the scene during 1966. Ed Wynn, Admiral Chester Nimitz, Buster Keaton, Senators Patrick McNamara, Harry Byrd, and Theodore Green, Hedda Hopper, Elizabeth Arden, Sophie Tucker, Francis X. Bushman, Gertrude Berg, Billy Rose, Charlie Dressen, Bob Swift, and Tony Lima, Deems Taylor, Evelyn Waugh, Walt Disney, and the New York Herald Tribune. Another familiar name left public life, retiring to contemplate a long and controversial priesthood.
"I cannot fight time, I cannot fight age, and I cannot fight progress. And it's a decision in this sense that I really believe that I should have a few months, perhaps, in the beautiful fields around here."
Father Charles Coughlin of the Shrine of the Little Flower. The world of popular music spun along, and there were some different sounds.
Winchester Cathedral, you're bringing me down.
An unlikely recording star made a rather belated debut.
Down through the years, there have been men.
Detroit's Motown empire again kept the top spot.
I need love, love, to ease my mind. I need...
Three young Detroit girls remained the Supremes. And there were mini skirts and the Monkees and topless waitresses and a host of now-forgotten fads that accompany each year. There were many other events. Perhaps they deserve more than a passing mention. There was Brookdale Cemetery, where bereaved relatives found unmarked graves and in some cases found none. There was a Garden City Day Nursery where tuberculosis infected 14 youngsters. There was a lengthy and as yet unresolved dispute over the I-696 freeway and where it should go. Many suburbs had an answer. There were anxious moments in Homer, Michigan, when a train wreck periled that small community with poisonous gas. There were four unarmed hydrogen bombs that fell off the coast of Spain. There was a man named Herbert Aptecker, whose Wayne State and Michigan State speaking engagements touched off a campus free speech furor. There were other names, William Manchester and a book on an assassination, a dying Jack Ruby in Dallas. There was what may be an annual debate over the Warren Commission. There was a magazine named Ramparts. There was a short-term Miss Michigan named Gail Ann Chancy, who took the long way home and lost her crown. There was Sandy Koufax and an arthritic arm, Frank Robinson and the Baltimore Orioles, and Harry Gilmer and a one-sided snowball fight. There was the game of the century in East Lansing with no winner. There was Truman Capote and a lavish party financed by a book about some cold-blooded killings in Kansas. There were divorces and weddings and a couple of youngsters named Pat and Lucy who went, we are told, to live happily ever after in Texas. There's a good deal of 1966 many of us would prefer to forget. Perhaps we will. But a lot of what happens in one year goes on to the next. Vietnam, crime, controversy, and politics. They'll all be with us. It is to be hoped 1967 will produce more positive answers. At any rate, the new year is here, and we'll all have our opportunities. For WKNR News, this is Philip Nye.